Welcome to the Northeast Divide podcast. Thank you for watching us on YouTube or listening to us on your free podcast providers. I'm your host, John Lane. And as ever, I'm joined by Anth as we talk about the two largest clubs in the Northeast, Newcastle United and Sunderland Football Club. And we are recording around about half an hour after Sunderland have managed a 0-0 draw at Elland Road. And that, well, I know that wasn't the result you were expecting because you predicted a 3-1 defeat in your video, which you can see on our Instagram and Twitter feeds. Yeah, what's your thoughts on that, then?
I'm not very good at score predictions, am I, John, to be fair? I think I'm just going to give up the ghost from now on. Like, that's why I don't bet or, yeah, do the pools, if that's still a thing, I don't know. Gobsmacked, to be fair. I thought Leeds were a bit sloppy tonight. I think they look nervous. And, yeah, I mean, it's tough at the top at the moment. I mean, look at the Leicester result tonight. That wonder goal from Millwall, outstanding. So it was a massive surprise. And when I was watching the match, the atmosphere, it is quite loud at Elland Road. It is quite intimidating. But there were times when you could hear our supporters over theirs. And it was a case of, what was the chant? Leeds are falling apart again, I think. So yeah, there's not a lot of warmth or affinity between the two teams, but I thought we were lucky. We could have had two red cards, and Ballard was very lucky, and 09 was incredibly lucky. So it was a tough game, and it was pretty much a defensive masterclass from us at times. It was like all hands on deck, but We did well, but we showed our shortcomings in certain areas of the pitch. There was a lot of players not up to it. Trihume was off the pace tonight. So we hung on at the end. But I'm happy with that. 0-0. Happy with that.
I think in isolation, it's a really good result. I think if you look at the two games together, 2 points from those two games. It's not the end of the world, but you would have probably wanted three on Saturday. And there's no point going and drawing away at Leeds if you can't beat the likes of Bristol and God knows who else you haven't beaten at home this year. And that's it, isn't it? And really, I think that's why you are where you are on the table. To be as nice as we can about it, the reason that he's a kind of going to finish mid-table mediocrity this year is because, you know, you're not able to kind of show that consistency. And you seem to be a better team away from home at the minute. Like, I mean, when's the last time you lost away from home? I don't know if it was as far away as Ipswich away, but, you know, it feels like it certainly feels like you kind of get up for it more when you're away from home than you do at the Stadium of Light.
I think, yeah, bang on the nail, John, bang on the nail. I think our away support, they always sell out the away allocation wherever they go. Obviously, Newcastle do the same. Massive followings. The biggest teams in the northeast of England. What they call again? Middlesbrough. They can't even fill the
water. They are. They are. Yeah. There's this other little team that play in yellow and black. Who you could say are northeast, but I mean they're miles away, aren't they? So
exactly. But I just think at home, We are quite nervous. The crowd, last season, they would support them if they put the effort in, but, you know, fell at the last hurdle. They were putting the effort in. They knew that we lacked a bit of quality at times, whereas this season, there's been a bit more sort of expectation and a lot more demands. And I think that has shown. There's been moans, there's been groans, and it's impacting upon the young players. Now, you can sort of, you know, make yourself vocal at the match. I don't believe in booing. I just think that's counterproductive and it's going to give the other team an advantage. So I think they thrive away from home. They thrive and they've got it. I don't know, they play with a bit more, they play a bit more cavalier. I mean, not tonight, obviously. It was just, like I say, yeah, a defensive sort of masterclass at times. Decent. Like I said, Ballard 09 though, very lucky. So we were very lucky.
I won't pretend that I watched the game. I watched about 10, 15 minutes of it. And do you know what it is? I think that's dedication, given the other games that were on tonight that I could have watched, yeah, which sounded like they were electric. But, you know, that is definitely for another podcast and not this one. I think part of the issue we've got in this region as football fans is, obviously, I think Keegan said it, didn't he, about Newcastle, is that, you know, people pay their money, they want to be entertained, right? They want to turn up, you know, they work hard all week and then they want to go. It's like someone down south going to the theatre. You're not getting that at Sunderland, to put it as nicely as I can. But I think there is an element of people do pay their hard-earned money to go and watch something. And even if it's not, like, ridiculously entertaining, you want to see your team really try and kind of give it everything. And if they're not giving it everything, then that will impact on the atmosphere. And we've seen it at St James's Park this year, right? And up until the 70th minute against West Ham, it was not a nice ground to be in. And as I said, we had a bloke behind us who I thought was going to have some sort of stroke or what have you, because of how angry he was getting. And, you know, and that was the, you know, famously quiet family enclosure where, you know, people will clap and cheer and what have you. So I think there is an element of that as well. Like if the team aren't looking like they're putting the effort in, that will affect the atmosphere. It will affect the way that the crowd react. And there needs to be an element of the players need to do their bit to give the team a reason to get behind. And that's what we had the other week against, as I say, against West Ham. When that penalty went in, that was it, the game. The whole momentum of the ground changed, and ultimately that helps the comeback as part of that. Yeah, yes, the players had to do a bit of that, but they responded. They responded to that, like, idea that, oh, actually, the fans still think we're in this. Let's give this a shot. I'm going to move on and talk about Newcastle. So we went to Fulham, got 3 points there. I don't know, did you see much of that, Anth?
Do you know what? I've seen the goal. But other than that, I'm a bit like you. Sometimes I didn't watch Match of the Day, man. But what's happened? It's me wife's birthday tomorrow, and we started on Saturday because that's the way she does it. What a woman! But a great result, man, for yous, honestly. And do you know what? I said you'd catch West Ham up, and I tell you what, you're catching them up.
Yeah, and it's funny, we recorded a podcast yesterday on this, and it's behind a paywall, guys, so apologies, I can't share it with you directly. We talked about the race for sixth and about kind of the different teams that are in and around it. And we felt as a group before anyway that we're going to finish either sixth or seventh based on kind of who the other teams are going to face and what have you and how that's going to go. So I'm pretty confident, looking at the fixtures we've got left, that we can, you know, we can get a good portion of points. And I think if we manage to get 12 points from our last seven games, I think that probably puts us in sixth place. I don't think Man United are great. I think it'll help if we can get at least a draw at their place. We've got to play them before the end of the season. But Spurs on Saturday now is huge. Now, you start to wonder then if Spurs start to drop some points, Could we catch them? I mean, I think they're too far. I mean, it's 13 points. It's that we've got to outscore them by to overtake them and go into fifth place. And I think that is probably just a bit of a stretch. And also, we still need a couple of favours in Europe. So West Ham being drawn against Bayer Leverkusen and Arsenal being drawn against Bayern Munich. Now, the reason that's critical for those of you that aren't sure is the coefficient race at the minute for the additional Champions League places is between England, Germany and Italy. Mm-hmm. So obviously the games that are England against Germany, which are Arsenal's and West Ham's, they're going to count in terms of that coefficient score. So that's where it starts to become really interesting. And then that's when we're looking at, is Champions League going to go to fifth? And then if Champions League goes to fifth, Europa League will go to at least sixth, possibly seventh if Man City win the FA Cup or Man United win that top six and win the FA Cup. So there's a couple of different permutations that could happen that then impact how far down they go. But I'm at the point now where I feel like we'll finish in the top seven, and I think that probably gets you into Europe. I'd be disappointed with seventh. I'd be really happy with sixth. That is kind of where I am with it. And you're right, Anth. I think we're in that race, and with the games we've got left, and some of the form is starting to show. And I don't know if I said this last week, but of the three games we've had, we've got 7 points, and I think we've drawn the best game we could have out of those three if we had to choose one to draw, because we're not in a fight with Everton, but we were kind of in a fight with Fulham and West Ham, so to take 3 points off them whilst, you know, getting points ourselves, that's obviously going to help.
Do you know, you're saying though, John, you're coming on strong towards the end of the season, and that's what you need to do, isn't it? It's like with the Championship playoffs, isn't it? Whoever's got the momentum normally goes on to sort of, you know, power on through. So, but with Spurs, though, when was it they bottled the title? Was it the Battle of Stamford Bridge?
That was, Leicester won it, wasn't it? It was 2016.
Was it?
Ah,
it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I remember that vividly because the year that Leicester won the league, the year that Newcastle got relegated. So thanks for bringing that up. But yeah, I was working in the States at the time for a few weeks, and they were showing the Spurs Chelsea game, and that was the game they lost. It wasn't it when Chelsea came back and won. So go on, I'll let you finish your point.
Yeah, well, do you know what? You've got to always be optimistic, haven't you? Because, yeah, pessimism's just drags you down. But being a Sunderland supporter, I know that. Anything's possible in football, isn't it? We've seen, like, I mean, look at Leicester. Look at Leicester now, struggling. So anything can happen, but Spurs are... He's got them playing good football. It's very open, free-flowing football, which Tottenham have obviously been famous for in the past. Your hoddle, your waddle, etc. The diamond lights. But there's also, when they play like that, they leave gaps at the back, don't they? So you could take advantage of that with the quality of players that you've got.
Yeah, but I think you also forget that we've got a patchwork back four going on at the minute.
I still have
it. So our back four at the minute, so we've got Lewis Hall at left back, who actually has looked really good the last couple of games since he's come in. And although he's cramping up in the last 10 minutes, you know, he's providing something. And it's, you know, a lot of Newcastle fans have been calling for him to play all season. Now, I trust Eddie Howe above, you know, random people around St James's Park. And I think most of us should feel that way, right? You know, we should trust that the fact that, like, you know, there's a reason he's getting paid a few million quid a year to manage the football club. He knows more about football than we do, right? But, you know, people have been calling for it, saying Dan Burn can't play at left back. You know, like, if he's going to play anywhere, he should play left centre half. We've kind of been forced to having to play that. Dan Burn's been excellent the last two games. He really has. You know, he had a goal chalked off against Everton, which was pretty tight as well. And he just looks comfortable in his own skin on the ball, in that part of the pitch. Cher continues to do what he does. The only issue we've got is just at a time when Kieran Trippier's injured, Livramento gets injured, who's basically his replacement waiting. So we have got Emil Kraft at right back, who he can do a job there, but let's just say against West Ham, there's a reason why he was pulled off, like, with about half an hour to go. And, you know, not in a good sense for him. So I think, look, he's, you know, he's, again, it's a patchwork back four. We still got Dubravka, you know, in goal as well. But, you know, aside from, like, a Paul Dummett wrestling move, like, we would have had two clean sheets in the last two games. And I think that's kind of, we're starting to kind of look like we're able to manage these situations and games better. What I would say is the first half an hour against Fulham, we were awful. Like, it's probably up there with the worst half an hour we've seen. And anyhow, bollocked them. What happened is Dubravka got injured. And at that stage, all of a sudden, all the players were able to go over and have a chat with Eddie. And Bruno was asked about what... He was asked by foreign TV what Eddie had said. And he basically said, yeah, he said, we weren't passing the ball fast enough. We weren't quick enough. Everything we were doing was slow, and that it wasn't Newcastle United. And it's really heartwarming as a fan to hear your manager talk about your club that way and say, actually, it's not good enough. And there was a clear reaction after that, after Dubravka recovered from his, you know, what was whatever was wrong with him, the poor guy. And from that stage, the momentum of the game did change. And, you know, we were the better side and we went on to win, and deservedly so. And the other part is we had a goal chalked off of VAR around about 74, 75 minutes. Have you seen the incident, Anth?
I haven't, no. No.
So the ball's crossed in from the right-hand side. Gordon whips the ball in. Dan Byrne goes up to try and win the header, but it goes past the box. And he's up there with Bassey, the centre-half, who falls over. And then it lands to Fabian Scher, who finishes off. There's no appeal at all from any player to say there's been a foul or whatever else. And then it goes to VAR and they look at it and they go, oh yeah, well, it looks like there's a foul there that Dan Byrne's made on the centre-half. Now, I know I'm a Newcastle fan saying that, but that's kind of how it felt watching it back, is that there wasn't an appeal there. Now, I think Dan Byrne potentially gives someone a decision to make, but for me, it's not clear and obvious. It's one of those. Now, you're lucky you don't have to deal with VAR being a Championship club. I mean, you've never had to deal with it, having VAR having come in after that period of time. But that is it is a frustration sometimes. And don't get me wrong, I think VAR has its faults, but it does create more correct decisions. Mm. So overall, over the balance of a season, it's you know, you will get more correct decisions. But ones like that where it feels like someone's re-refereed it, that's where it becomes a bit frustrating.
Do you know, it's a case of be careful what you wish for, isn't it? Because before VAR, everyone was bemoaning the fact that some of the refereeing decisions made were just terrible. You know, it does happen occasionally. And I'm sure Big Dave, who was in the family enclosure looking resplendent in his Stone Island, bursting a blood vessel after his pre-match 8 pints, probably thinks he knows better than Eddie Howe, but he definitely doesn't, does he? So, you know, I think Eddie Howe, like I've said before, you know, he is obviously our biggest rival's manager, but I like the fella. He's a great manager. And, you know, what I will say about Newcastle United, you're stuck with him. The supporters stuck with him. The majority anyway. I mean, you probably know more than me with regards to the poor run of form, etc. And he's turned it around. He's turned it around and he's got his going again. And like you said, the chat that he had saying, like, you know, that's not us. We know what we're capable of. We can play better than that. Masterstroke. So all credit to the fella.
Yeah, and I think that look, there's always going to be some noise, right? But I actually think a lot of that is generated outside. Like, I think that national media make a bit of a thing about Eddie Howe because he's not a big name. And Newcastle are, you know, they've obviously got very rich owners. So there's almost like, I feel like there's almost an obsession with Newcastle around what are they going to spend in the transfer window? Like who could they bring in as a different manager later on, and they're the kind of conversations that happen externally. But I think internally, from a fan base point of view, we just try and judge it based on what we see. Now, I think there's some questions coming up which have come up at Bournemouth before around, you know, a lot of injuries, maybe relying on the same players or trusting the same players too much, and you can see some of those arguments potentially, but I do feel like it's not like you had what McBeal had to deal with at Sunderland, where the fan base were never on board with them and a lot of them never wanted him or never wanted to really give him a chance. And as soon as, you know, every time there was a defeat, that was it. You know, well, he has to go with the manager and whatever else. With how you've almost had. If anyone's like, look, you know, we just need to give it a little bit more time, you then have the loud minority who are like, oh, well, you know, like you can't just trust him all the time, you know, like, you know, you've got to be allowed to say like he's not good or whatever. And that's fine. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. Mm. But I think if you look at what Eddie Howe did last year, if you look at the, and I suppose this is a question, what's a bigger achievement? Keeping us up in 21-22 from the position he did, or take the Champions League the following year. They're both massive achievements. This year, we looked like at one point we'd be lucky if we were going to finish in the top half at one point, and now we're probably favourites to finish sixth, or maybe, well, probably favourites to finish seventh, but you know, certainly with a good shout of sixth.
Do you know what you're saying there about big name managers and what have you? And sometimes, you know, the names that are bandied around it sound very attractive, but they don't always guarantee you success, do they? They get by on past glories, past reputation. I mean, Mourinho, for example, he, tremendous at Chelsea, you know, and then, yeah, after that, just, yeah, not so good. So, yeah. I think, do you know what, he's a rare commodity, because he's English, he's young, and he's got a lot of years of managerial sort of ahead.
I know what you're trying to say. too many beers. The thing is, right, and you mentioned Mourinho, someone like Jose is always going to be linked with Newcastle, because actually Bobby Robson wanted him to go in at Newcastle, and then Abramovich came along. That's basically what happened. I think had Bobby Robson not exited Newcastle the way he did, I think there's probably a really good chance that Mourinho was certainly up there as a candidate that was going to come in. However, yeah, obviously the money was at Chelsea, and it was a really good opportunity for him to go there, wasn't it? But you'll always be linked because of that link with Robson. Personally, and I'm not saying, I want to be really clear the way I say this, I wouldn't have Rafa Benitez back, but I'd rather Rafa Benitez was back than Jose Mourinho came in. I just think he's all about Jose. I think that's all he cares about. And we've had a bit of a no dickheads policy in terms of players. We need to make sure we do the same in terms of the coaching staff. And Eddie Howe is very much about what's best for Newcastle United. And I think that should be a minimum requirement of any manager, that they try and do what's best for your club. I feel like I've talked about Newcastle for a while. So I'm gonna throw it back and go back to the red and white side of the Northeast Divide. Any news on managers? Any rumours kind of circulating? Anything in particular that looks like it might happen? I mean, we're just kind of slowly stumbling towards the end of the season now.
Usual suspects. I mean, I don't think it's changed. Yeah, your Will Stills, etc. Sheffield Wednesday manager, but there's a lot of compensation involved apparently. And apparently, Jermaine Defoe's thrown his hat into the ring. So, and he's got a backroom staff already lined up. But apparently, whatever manager comes in is not going to be able to bring along a whole host of backroom staff. So I think they want some of the coaching staff that are there now to be still there. Which, we'll get back to the whole the Dodds thing and what have you. I mean, I like the fella. He comes out with a bit of cack babble, like. I've read some of his.
What a phrase!
Honestly, pre-match stuff of late, I'm like, what's he on about? But anyway, he seems like a nice fella. But is he part of the problem? Possibly. Maybe we need a total, not just managerial, but the model needs tweaking, like you've mentioned previously. Because, you know, we can't just rely on young players. We need some experienced heads. We need someone who's going to lead the team and show that experience. And hopefully the young players would take inspiration from that. So, but the list of names hasn't really changed.
The thing that's really frustrating about the model, or the idea of the model, is it feels, I think, you know, obviously, this takes me back like 3 or 4 years, right, where this is kind of what Ashley had initially said he wanted to do, right? It's probably nearer 10 years ago, actually, in fairness. He wanted to bring in young players, which had good resale value, right? Great idea. Makes sense, right? All on board with that. Don't have an issue, right? But, like, you need somebody who can coach them. Like, you need somebody who's a good coach who can develop the player so then you can actually sell them. You know, there's, I mean, I don't know if you've heard the story, Ant, about when Newcastle were in for Modric before he went to Spurs. And basically the link was Modric's agent was a massive Hamburg fan. So obviously he's a huge fan of Kevin Keegan for that reason. And the one of the directors that Ashley Depay was Wise and this other bloke was basically saying, oh no, we think he's too lightweight, we don't think he's going to be able to handle it, and basically put him off the move to Newcastle. And people can say, oh well, it would have been great if you'd brought Modric in, but there's no guarantee that if you don't have the coaching staff around that to nurture the talent that you're going to get the same player. Like, Modric potentially is a better player, and it's the same argument as, and this is going back a long way, Newcastle signed a Portuguese player from Sporting Lisbon at the same time Man United did. Now, the Man United player, as you probably will remember, was Cristiano Ronaldo. We signed a guy called Hugo Viana. Now, if you swap those transfers around, and let's say that Viana goes to Man United and Ronaldo comes to Newcastle, do you get the same Cristiano Ronaldo who then goes to Real Madrid and has the career he has? I don't necessarily think you do. I think, like, things have got to kind of be right. And I think this is part of the appeal Newcastle have got now. And I know I've brought it back over here again. But this is the appeal that we've got, really, is that you've got a coach that can develop these players. Look at Anthony Gordon and the difference between him last January to the player that he is now and what he's doing. And he's challenging. And I think he probably should be on the plane to Germany in the summer. But a lot of that is because of the work that's gone in behind. And I think Sunderland need to think about this. When they bring in their next coach, they need somebody who can coach players. They need someone that can develop talent, because actually if their model is, we're going to buy them young, we're going to develop them, we're going to get them to a point and we're going to sell them, they need a really good coach there to do that.
And you know, Mowbray was that man with regards to bringing on the young players and nurturing them, encouraging them, giving them the confidence, throwing a protective arm around them when needed, you know. And obviously, Beal, when he came in and the Hume incident where he didn't see him, but he did see him. I just thought,
he definitely saw him.
Yeah, he definitely saw him, didn't he? I just thought it summed up the man. A little bit of arrogance there, whereas Mowbray, affable, likeable. I hope he's on the mend health wise as well. I do, and yeah, get me big bag of Revels.
Bless him, I know.
I think you're right. We need to really think long and hard about the next manager that we're gonna have in, and have we already got someone lined up, or are we struggling to get someone lined up? I don't know what's happening behind the scenes, because I don't know. I think sometimes the owners need to open up a little bit more and provide a bit more information. It's all a bit, it seems a bit guarded at times. But then we look back at, like, the ownership of Ellis Short and how he was just, you know, just throwing money around at absolute mercenary players, just the worst of the worst, some of them. I'm not mentioning names again because I'll need to take six swigs of me beer. But yeah, so we need to get it right, and we need to, you know, maybe tweak the model. But
yeah,
hopefully we'll have someone lined up soon. Fingers crossed.
And that's it. And I think, yeah, we've talked about the model before, haven't we? I think it's about having that dynamic, the principle of bringing young players in and developing them. And look, Newcastle are doing that, like, at the minute, right? And we've got owners that are richer than God, right? And, you know, we're bringing in... No, but that's true, isn't it? Like, let's be honest. You know, like, you know, if this was 2003, we could literally buy pretty much anyone that we wanted that wasn't going to one of the big two or three clubs in the country without any issue at all in terms of funding, right? But we're not in that world anymore. But, you know, we're buying players like Anthony Gordon. We're buying players like Tino Livramento, who... You know, these are, you know, Lewis Hall, the young players that are going to get coached really well, and they're going to develop, and they're going to become, you know, our future, basically. And you can't have a model like that if you don't have all the ingredients. But similarly, we've also got some experienced players in there, you know, like Kieran Trippier, like Dan Byrne, like Callum Wilson. And there's an argument for what do some of those players contribute on the pitch, or can they contribute because they're injured or what have you. But ultimately, you need that dynamic. And if you don't have the wise heads to help the young heads, how do the young heads get wise? You know, what you don't want is like 11 players looking lost. And like, and I'm sorry to bring it up, but you know, I think back to that January day, the one thing you didn't have was that character that you needed, I don't think. And we had that. It was men against boys. It was quite evident. You know, and the biggest cheer at Stadium of Light, really, from the home end, was when Luke O'Neill went through Lewis Miley. Like, you know, like with a big tackle, and it's like, well done, you've hacked down a 17-year-old, congratulate, you know, like. But that was like the peak of that game for you, really, in a lot of ways. And again, it's there needs to be that mix, and on paper, something can look like a good idea, or you know, on a spreadsheet, you can look and go, well, if we can buy a player for 200,000 and sell him for 10 million, then we'll make money, and that'll help us go. Yeah, it will, but you need results as well. Like you need as a club to feel like you're going somewhere. And you know, the Championship is such a hard division to get out of. And the way it's going, the way that these clubs drop down, you know, Leeds we're talking about, obviously you've had a great result against them tonight, you know, but it'll probably be them and Leicester that go up in the end, but they've had such an advantage financially just because of the nature of, you know, the parachute payments and everything else. So that's where we are. So speaking of financial advantages, Anth, I don't know if you've seen this week that the Premier League clubs, they're obviously discussing changes that they want to make to the profit and sustainability rules. And there's been, one of the suggestions that's been raised in these meetings is a luxury tax. So I don't know if you remember what Kieran was talking about a couple of weeks when he guested on the show, Kieran Maguire. If anyone hasn't seen it, please go back and watch it. It's class. Basically, the idea being that you pay over a certain threshold, then you'll then pay a premium to spend more, but it would allow clubs to spend more who are richer, and then that money would then go to the other clubs in the league and potentially down the pyramid. Is this something that you think the Premier League would end up passing, I suppose? And if so, would it help a club like Sunderland in the long run? And would that then potentially give a chance for Kirill, whatever he's called, to put his hand in his pocket and maybe throw a bit more at Sunderland and potentially break you out of the sustainable model just to get you to where you need to get to so you then can be more sustainable?
Do you know, I'm a bit suspicious of that. I don't really know a lot about it. You know more than me, but I don't know at what stage it's at. Where the discussions are.
It's been raised in a meeting, right? So my understanding, and there's another podcast that will be on Free to Air YouTube that you'll see in the next couple of days. If you're looking around for True Faith. But basically what the information that a journalist has been given essentially, or kind of had wind of, is that it's been raised as an idea in the meeting, the luxury tax idea. It's not like it's kind of, this is the proposal, but that's one of the things that was raised. So the idea of the luxury tax being, if you, spend over, let's say your budget was 100 million for argument's sake, right? But you spent like 150, like 50 million of that would then have to be paid on top as like a luxury tax. And then you'd split, say 25 million would go to the rest of the Premier League clubs and the other 25 million would go to the rest of the pyramid. That's the idea behind it anyway.
The journalist in question though, didn't work for the Sun or the Daily Mail, did he? Because I've
No. He's a credible journalist. Is he?
All right. Okay. Then.
I promise you he's a credible journalist. He's a good guy. We asked him the question and he said, oh, well, it's not at the stage where they're like, this is a final proposal. It's kind of like, this is the idea of it. But I think the other thing with the luxury tax, in the States, the way that those leagues work is they're like franchise models. Mm-hmm. So you have like 32 teams in the NFL. They don't do that system. I think it's the NBA that do. But the idea is that the money just goes to the other franchise clubs that have stayed within the cap is the idea behind it. And would that work here with the football pyramid and the Premier League? But it feels like a lot of Newcastle fans looked at it, and all of a sudden there was all the Shane McMahon music videos getting shared over Twitter with "Here Comes the Money," and suggesting that, because that it would be a game changer for Newcastle, because it would allow them to unlock some of that PIF money if they really wanted to.
And that would mean Mbappe is finally on the way, because obviously he's on the way, isn't he?
Absolutely not.
But yeah, I mean, it's a lot to think about, isn't it? And I'm sure it's going to take a lot of planning and, you know, to implement it and get everyone on board. There will be people who are suspicious. There will be people thinking, well, you know, ulterior motives, will it benefit sort of, you know, certain clubs? Yes, if money filters down to the lower leagues, Championship, for example, where we are. Massive team. Anyway, I don't know enough about it. I'm going to do a bit more research on it. You've given us something to think about there.
What they need to do is they need to change the regulations, I think. And I think January transfer window for me was a massive turning point for the Premier League generally, because it was probably one of the most boring transfer windows that there's been. So I think that's really harmful for the brand generally. They don't want to be in a position where clubs can't invest and can't spend, because then the product gets damaged from that point of view. They need to also be wary of UEFA's regulations, because they need to kind of align to that, because then if clubs qualify for Europe, they need to then be in a position where they can be compliant, because there's no point being able to do what you want in the Premier League and then not being able to do that in Europe, and then you're going to get penalised there. So I think there's a lot of moving parts with it. Now, my theory is that the Premier League is governed by self-interest, essentially. They're going to try and make rules that are going to benefit them, but so are UEFA. Or some of those clubs. Now, you know, there's 12 clubs that wanted to run away and make their own league, and essentially they're still calling the shots at that top table. And the current guidelines, the way that they are, and even with the changes that UEFA want to make in terms of, I don't know if you've seen, but it's a percentage now, so your player costs would have to be within 70% of your revenue. So, you know, if you brought in like £1 billion revenue, you could spend £700 million on player fee, wages, and agent fees, essentially. That's the idea behind it. But the thing is you've got clubs like Man City, who at the top of the Premier League, who I think their revenue is like over £600 million. And then you've got, you know, a club like Luton, whose revenue might be like 120. And then Luton are able to spend, I think, 85% because they haven't qualified for Europe. But Man City can spend 70, but their 70% is so much bigger than the 85. So something has to change somewhere. Profit and sustainability. When the target is to lose 105 million over a rolling three-year period, and that's seen as a good thing if you haven't lost that, that doesn't sound very sustainable to me. I don't know about you, but I think I'd struggle to maintain my household if I was losing 105 million over a 3-year period. I think most businesses struggle to stay in business under those conditions. And, you know, but this is it. And as Kieran said the other week to us, you know, the likes of Bristol City are losing 20 million a year. Like, the owner just pumps that money in and loses that money. And it doesn't really, it's just normal. Like, and that's not a sustainable way for football to be. So they need to do something that keeps the competitive balance, but also, you know, keeps clubs sustainable. And similarly, do not put clubs in, you know, a lot of Newcastle fans will be about to throw stuff at their laptops or their tablets or the TV when I say this. But you shouldn't be able to come in as a sovereign state, sovereign wealth fund, buy any football club and then propel it to the top just by pumping money in unlimitedly. There needs to be some sort of regulation because, look, there's sport there, but also it shouldn't land with six clubs that are at the top because of circumstance and because they're now in a position where, you know, Man United will always be commercially very successful because they were the most successful side in the Premier League for the first 10 to 15 years of the league. So how do you, how you can't really break that bit of it. But similarly, they shouldn't just be able to stay there because that's where they are, and they shouldn't then just dictate the rules to make sure that everyone stays in their place. So anyway, I digress a lot. Newcastle and Sunderland have big games at the weekend. So Newcastle play Spurs at St James' Park, which I've won a ballot ticket for, so I will be there.
Oh, nice one, man. Nice
one. End. Yep, so I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully, I don't think it's going to be as good as the Spurs game last year, you know, where we scored five goals in less than 20 minutes. But you know, I think, you know, we've got the chance of getting a result there. I will make a prediction and it will be on our social media platforms in the next couple of days. And Sunderland, I've got West Brom away. After the last two games you've had, you know, keeping clean sheets, not scoring goals, but, you know, like, you got a chance of doing something, possibly.
Yeah, yeah. We're still firing blanks, but, you know, hopefully one day we'll torpedo someone's goal. Might be West Brom. Who knows? Always a tough game down at the Hawthorns. Very tough game. I can't remember if it was last season or the season before, though, when Sirkin played just like world class, and he got the goal to where it was tremendous. Like, but West Brom have shown, I mean, they didn't really start the season off very well, did they? But they've again powered on through, and they've shown the quality, they've got the squad depth, and they're up there. So, yeah.
I mean, they're in fifth at the minute. I mean, they're 6 points clear of Coventry, who are in seventh. So, in terms of the playoffs, then they're too far off the promotion push because Leicester, Leeds and Ipswich are so far ahead, I think, of everyone else. You know, I think that ship's definitely sailed, but they're probably skirting close to the point where they're kind of already in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about kind of, they need to maintain some kind of form in order to have a chance when the playoffs hit. To have a chance of promotion. And West Brom, with a lot of the financial difficulties they've had over the last couple of years, are probably pretty desperate for that. But look, I think, you know, I think if you can go to Leeds and get a point, you can go to West Ham and you can upset them. And we've said it already, you tend to travel better than you kind of play at home, I suppose. So we'll see. But Anth, I'm sure you will do a prediction, and we'll get that up. We'll get those up on Friday, on X, on Instagram, and maybe on YouTube as well, on the shorts there. But everybody for listening, thank you so much for listening. And thank you for your time this evening, as always. We're probably not going to do a show next week. I'm away on holiday with the family. So we're going to have a bit of a break. But we will be back to discuss Newcastle's push for that top six and Sunderland's push to mid-table mediocrity. If you've liked watching the video and listening to it, please rate us on your platforms. So press like if you like the video. Rate us as 5-star if you enjoyed us on one of your audio platforms. And please leave us comments. And we said it the other week, it doesn't matter what you say. As long as you say something and give us some feedback, that will help us improve. And as I say, we're on Instagram and X at Northeast Divide. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.